All right, good morning, everybody. Let's find a seat if you can amidst the chaos. Missed all the jumble seats. I was watching some of your faces this morning as you entered, and the chairs were not in straight rows. Some of you, that did not work for you. And the sense that you had was, this needs to be fixed, and it needs to be fixed now. I don't have a lot of margin left, and so let's just get these, you know, into straight rows. It's interesting, being in chaos is really part of the human condition. We are always moving from chaos to order. If you look at the meta-narrative of creation, there's a nice little verse in Genesis somewhere where it says that there was chaos, and out of that God said, and creation begins to form. I was just recently in Hawaii for a couple of weeks. I know that's sad news, but somebody had to do it. And we were there for a couple of weeks, so I thought it would be good idea to read James Michener's book, Hawaii, which is really interesting, and it spoke to the message that I want to talk about this morning. And in there, he talks about how the islands were formed, and this it comes out of chaos, and there's order, and it took millions of years, and it's a really interesting graphic conversation about from chaos to order. And then I was really struck by the first landing of what they believe is the people from Bora Bora. Took about a 2,000-mile trip up to the Hawaiian Islands, and how they got there. And a lot of their superstitions and a lot of their ways of being around spirituality was this idea of omens. And if a shark came up on this side of the boat, or if an albatross came here, or if a dolphin appeared, it meant something. And that's how they got from Bora Bora up to the Hawaiian Islands. And when they got to the Hawaiian Islands and they saw the volcano and they saw a mountain that they'd never seen before, and it was smoke was billowing out of it, their immediate response was, the gods must be angry. What do we need to do to appease the gods? And a lot of sacrifice and human sacrifice and that kind of stuff went on. I was struck by the fact that many thousands of years later, when the first missionaries showed up, and they were from the Calvin School of Theology, and they had their own omens, their own ways of appeasing the gods. Making sure that you don't sin, and making sure that you're obedient, and making sure this is happening and this is happening. And I was struck by the contrast that now we've got this one big God, and yet we still have to have all of these omens to make sure that we're doing it right. Because in many ways, in a confessional type of Christianity, we approach getting to heaven, being the end game, as kind of some final test that we have to take. And do you believe in A, B, C, D, and E? Oh, you don't believe in E? Go to hell. It's kind of how we approach it, because you have to have the whole loaf of bread. You have to buy everything. And if you don't line up exactly, then you're in serious trouble. And I think that there's a wonderful story that I want to reference today. And when I chatted with Vince about this series that we're doing from chaos to order, and how to manage that, I was given the passage from Deuteronomy chapter 1, where the Israelites are going on a journey. It's about 2 years since they've come out of Egypt. So just to put this in context, they're leaving Egypt. And they come out, now they're wandering around. Now, I don't know about you, but one of the pieces that strikes me as interesting about that, you think the chairs being not aligned is chaos. Can you imagine leaving a country, not having your own place? You've got to do the civil engineering for about 1 million people. Now, according to the narrative, there is manna that is there, which the people got bored of quite quickly. They were kind of tired of the manna bread every morning, and they were wanting leeks and onions, and they were wanting a whole bunch. And they started to complain very quickly into the journey. And early on in the journey, this certain sense of uncertainty and this sense of chaos and lack of order in the narrative creates this complaining, creates this sense of needing something that's going to give meaning to or give sense to the chaos that's going on. Let me share a story with you that happened while we were away on vacation. And I have permission to share this. But one of the couples that was with us, the wife's father was very, very ill. And he's in his 80s, and he's literally in the last couple of months, maybe couple of weeks of his life. He's all swollen up, and his kidneys have shut down. And when we were about to leave, she was caught between, do I go? This vacation had been planned a long time ago. It's already paid for. Do I go? Do I stay? You know, she asked her parents, what do you think? And they said, no, go. You'll be fine. Asked brothers and sisters, oh, no, you'll be fine. You go. And so she did. She came on the vacation, and literally 2 days into the vacation, she is burned up with guilt and trying to make sense of being in Hawaii on a beach, enjoying herself while her dad is in the hospital in Edmonton, really sick. Now, I don't know about you, but that's not an easy scenario to solve. And either which way, it's kind of like a lose-lose, it feels like. You know, I've got this vacation, I've already paid for it, I'm here in Hawaii, I'm having a great time, but what do I do? So she's gone through this for about 3 days. On the fourth day, she wakes up and she comes out and she declares this. She said, last night, God spoke to my heart and said, I gotta go home. I said, great. So her husband gets on the phone, changes the ticket. The next day, they're booked to go home. She then gets on the phone and lets her dad know that she's coming home. Now, he's, you know, still quite alert and really super nice guy, but, and she tells him, she says, Dad, I'm coming home tomorrow. And he says, quote unquote, what the hell are you doing that for? You're in Hawaii. Please stay there. And then her mom gets on the phone and saying, please don't come home. You're fine. And so there was a real definitive sense of staying, and she was okay with that. And so, so she did. She ended up staying. So about 4 or 5 hours later in the afternoon, I was sitting out on Lanai and we were chatting, and I said, tell me about the God told me piece. Because I'm going, if God told you to go home and now you're not going home because your earthly father told you not to, something's not kind of, what was that about? Can we have a conversation about it? So certainly you can. And I said, possibly, when you're feeling anxiety and we're trying to make meaning, when we're in chaos, when there is a lot of uncertainty and we don't know what to do, one of the things that we have done traditionally, and we've been doing it for thousands of years, is we get the God card out. Because if God tells me to do it, then guess what? It's okay. You with me? Anybody who use the God card, like you're having an argument with your husband and you go, yeah, but God said, right? And as soon as you play the God card, that ends the conversation for all intents and purposes. Because what am I going to do? Argue with God? Right? I'm not going to take God on. And the only other piece is maybe you didn't hear from God. And that's not a conversation I want to enter into. You with me? Well, it's interesting because in the biblical narrative, we see this phrase, God said, to justify an awful lot of things that you and I today would feel are unjustifiable. And that's the case in this particular narrative. Because as the children of Israel are wandering, after 2 years of doing this, they then get this, and there's a really cryptic line. I think it's, I love this line, in Deuteronomy 1, verse 2. It says, normally it only takes 11 days to travel from Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. And I love that little phrase. Normally it only takes 11 days. Now, for those of us that are familiar with the history, we know that they wandered for 40 years. Which is why this lovely little verse says, well, normally it takes 11 days. But this chaotic, uncertain, rebellious community, it took them 40 years. So how come? And that's this narrative. And they play the God card and they said that, well, God has told us to go in and take this land. Now, you got to understand the context of this, because conquering and expanding and taking land and property was kind of the way of being back in the ancient days. Right up until really the last 50 years, conquering has always been there. First World War, Second World War, Civil Wars. You know, you look at the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire, you know, the Babylonian Empire. You've got all of these empires, and the whole deal was about expanding our territory and taking land that wasn't really ours. And that way of being, it's kind of like, this is the way I picture it, it's kind of like today we have spring training in baseball. That's kind of says the spring is here. Back in the ancient days, they would kind of get their swords out and go, okay, who are we going to fight today? It was their sport. It was their way of being. They didn't have games as we do, but they would go and conquer. And the one card they would play that justified their conquering was God said. And the Jewish community says, well, God said, go in and take the Amorite territory. And so they said, well, maybe we should send some spies in there to check it out. So they did. They sent some spies in, and the spies go in. And in this particular passage, the spies go, well, those are really big walls, and those are really big people, and we're basically hooped. And so then the entire community goes, well, we're not doing that. And they start to complain. And so the judgment then from God is that now none of you that complained and none of you that wanted to go in and actually take the land that God is giving you are going to enter into that land. And it took 40 years for that generation to die off, a new one to come along, and for that to eventually take place. So that's the context of that. Now, when we look at this, if you were to take a view of this from a psychological perspective, all right, why is this story important? What is it that was valuable that we keep that narrative and we keep retelling? I mean, how often do you hear, and they wandered for 40 years? I think a big part of it is, how do we manage anxiety? How do we deal with the uncertainty? Can you imagine wandering around in a desert for 40 years with all of the civil engineering issues that you would have? It's kind of like Burning Man, but with no infrastructure, right? It's kind of like this craziness that goes on, and you go, okay, but this is not, why are these chairs not lined up? Because when I show up to church, I need to know that they're in the right order. And I need that certain sense of certainty. We need to know that things are going to be certain. We have a human need for certainty. And without it, when we walk into this level of uncertainty, it creates for us a level of anxiety. And immediately when we feel anxiety, what we want to do is we want to push it down and fix it. Hence the story, I'm going home. God told me. Because as soon as you say, God told me to go home, my anxiety goes from here down to here. And we want to fix our anxiety. Now, the problem with anxiety is that when it is unconscious and we are not aware of it, it can run and drive our lives. And we end up behaving and feeling and thinking in certain ways because of the anxiety. You and I, us as a community, live in a culture and a world where stress is just a given. We live in a chaotic world where there's a lot of uncertainty. We live in this stressful world where we move from this to this to this to this. And we go at a pace. I was thinking of this. It took me about 5.5 hours to go from Vancouver to Hawaii. It took the first missionaries that went there 8 months to do that same trip, to sail from Boston around the tip of the horn at the bottom of South America, 8 months to do the same trip. Question for you. Do you think that the certain level of meditation that would go on and the pace of life, comparing 8 months to 5 hours, and we are able to move and go places that back in the day, I'm not sure we were designed to do it. And so the rapid pace with which we can move and change geography and change things creates for us a certain level of stress, and that stress, we are so used to it that we don't even know it's there. Now, here's the interesting piece. When we have stress, when we're stressed out, there is a hormone that's released in our system, and you've probably heard of it, cortisol. Now, some of the coaching that I do is I work with some athletes, and it's interesting that when cortisol is released in a system because of stress, it actually decreases performance. So, for example, if you're a sprinter, to go fast, you have to relax to go fast. Now, just think about the paradox of that. I'm tense, I'm ready to go, the gun goes off, and I got to relax. That does not mean you fall asleep at the start line, right? But what it means is, as soon as I get stressed, the cortisol goes up and my performance goes down. So for those of you that have played any kind of sport, you've experienced that moment where you get in the zone, where you're playing basketball and everything you do, you just kind of hit it, and you're playing golf and you're putting stuff. And any golfers here, you've had that moment where you go, boy, this game's easy. Right? You're going, I'm just killing it today. It's like I got 5 pars in a row and look at me. Oh, the birdie. Oh, yeah. Right? And you're relaxed and you just think everything's going to go in. Yeah, because there's no cortisol happening. And then you miss one. Darn it. Right? And immediately the stress goes up, the anxiety goes up, the cortisol comes out, and your performance goes down. And that's what we live with in our culture and in our world. So part of this morning for us and learning from the ancients is, how do we then become aware of that anxiety? What are some tools that we can have so we can bring the anxiety out of unconsciousness into consciousness so that we then get to make choices? Okay? So let me introduce you to an interesting drama, okay? Back in 1968, there was a German psychologist called Stephen Karpman. Some of you may have heard of him, and he was famous for writing an article in 1968 that was called the Karpman Drama Triangle. He did it in a kind of a fairy tale type of way. That drama triangle has been used in many different ways and in different contexts. The traditional way that it was used is that we, as people within a family system, can take on different roles. And the classic that he used back in the day was the alcoholic with the codependent and with the rest of the family. And it was a family system that got set up. And we all have these family systems that run our lives. And it's how we cope in relationships. Most of it's unconscious. Most of it we don't think about. But Karpman used this. What I'd like to do this morning is kind of adjust that. And rather than talk about it as a family system, let's talk about it in terms of the roles that we play. I do the Karpman's Triangle. I have sat on every seat in the Karpman's Triangle, and that's why I thought it would be a very helpful tool to help us to manage our anxiety. And whether it's as small as the chairs not being lined up, or as major as losing a job, or as, you know, going through life change, going through children leaving, going through divorce, going through the loss of something. All of these things produce this stress and the anxiety and the uncertainty. You walk into your job, which you're certain of, and somebody hands you a pink slip, and now that certainty is gone, and now you're just left with, what's next? how do I manage this? And if you've gone through that, or if you've gone through the breakup of a relationship and you go, okay, what was certain is now no longer certain, how do I manage that? Cartman said that we all start our journey, and I want to introduce you to the first word that Cartman said. He says that we all start out by being the victim. Right now, this is not a compliment, and most of you are going, not me. Right? But we do. We all begin by being the victim. And the victim chair is the one we start on. And the victim asks the question, expectations do I have that cannot be met? Now, you think about this. The people that were wandering the desert felt like they were being victimized. They felt like, I've done something wrong. Like, what, you know, this should not be happening. If God has released us from the captivity in Egypt, then everything should be just fine. If I could just get to this, then everything's going to be fine. And yet, I'm not feeling very powerful. Right now, I'm feeling like a loss of power, because victims do not have any power. And when you sit on this chair, you're going, okay, life is happening to me. You know, why is life unfair? I said to my kids, all of them, I said, the faster we figure out life's not fair, the quicker we can get on with life and enjoy it. Life, everybody say this, life's not fair. It's just not. But when we feel like it's happening to us from the outside in, we can often feel like a victim, right? And the victim then, if you are victim for long enough, and if you add time to being victim, what is the emotion that gets created when you're a victim for a long time? What's the emotion? What? Helplessness, yes, but what, there's an emotion underneath that. What's the emotion? Resentment, which is a subset of anger. So here's what Cartman said. He said, what happens is that we're a victim, and then we come over here, and the victim and all that emotion creates anger. And then he said, then we become the persecutor. We act out in some inappropriate way. Our addictions, not that any of you here have them. I'm an addict. I am an alcoholic. And I've been sober for at least 4 minutes, so I'm doing well. Actually, 40 years is what I've gotten sobriety. But the issue here is that this, right, the acting out, you can see it's very, I'm a victim, I add time, I get angry, screw it. And, you know, you go out and just, the classic ones, go out and drink. Get absolutely hammered. And then you wake up the following morning, not too sure what happened the night before. And when you've acted out, what's the emotion that happens after you've acted out? What do you feel? Shame. Exactly. And so then we're the persecutor, and then we act out, and now I feel really bad, not just about what I've done, but about who I am. Right? So now I'm feeling shame. And so what Cartman said is, we then come over to this chair, and now we got to fix it. We've got to rescue. Now, I know none of you have ever rescued anybody. I get that. But the rescuing is something that happens after I have acted out. Right? So here's the classic. Feeling like a victim. Life is happening to me. I have no power. I get angry. I get blow up. Doesn't matter what the blow up is. Doesn't matter what your addiction of choice is or what your way of coping is. Eventually, boom, this is going to happen. You know, you have a fight with your spouse and everything else, and it's not the first time this has happened, right? Don't all look so innocent at me like, oh, who are you talking? What planet are you from? No, this is real stuff, folks. This is what happens before you come to church. Hello, we're driving to church and we're having this argument. And then we walk in and, well, praise God. How are you? Oh, I'm wonderful. Right? and you've just mouthed off to your significant other or your kids, and you know, you've got these demons in the back of the car and they're just killing you, and it's like everything, chaos is happening, and boom, you blow up, and then you feel bad. And so then you get to church and you go, okay, I gotta fix it. I'll go serve in children's church this morning. I'll make it all better. Right? Or I go home and I buy flowers for my wife. Right? And we try to fix that and we rescue. We try to make it all better. Right? You know, classic one, gone to the casino. I spent a little more than I anticipated. Right? Just a little scotch more. Hello. Yeah. Okay. And then come over here. It's like, oh my goodness. I got to fix this. So honey, I'm going to buy this for you. I'm going to make it better. And so we start to rescue. We start to fix. We buy flowers and it's, none of it's appreciated. People don't go, oh, that you're wonderful. And so the rescuer then after rescuing comes back over here. What do you end up feeling like? You end up feeling like a victim and you come back here again. And the cycle starts all over again. Some of you feel very comfortable being the victim. As a matter of fact, if you look up the word victim, your picture's right there in the dictionary. You like the seat. You play victim. You know, it's happening to me. You know, it's not my fault. It's everybody else's fault, even though you're the only common denominator. Hello? Right? And so I play big and I feel comfortable here, but over time I get angry, boom, it blows up and now I become the persecutor. Now some of you, you feel comfortable here. Some of you just love being the persecutor because this feels powerful. And if anger is your default emotion, then you are familiar with this chair. Right? You can see it in the narrative. In the people of Israel, there's anger that's there. There's this frustration that comes and the anger gets projected at the leadership, gets projected at God, it gets projected at the people that we care about. Because for the most part, and here's the deal, we're not conscious that we're sitting here. We're not conscious that we're being the victim. Because it's happening to us, because when I'm in this chair and I have expectations that cannot be realistically met, it takes away my power. And I'm feeling powerless. I end up feeling angry. And then I feel shame. And this shame, right in here, is such an insidious, crippling emotion. It paralyzes us. We don't want to feel it, but it feels anxiety. It feels shameful. It's not just I've done something wrong. I am wrong. I didn't just get drunk last night. I am a drunk. Right? I didn't just blow up. You are angry. Right? We embody that emotion. And when we embody that, we just feel worse and worse. And so we come here, we've got to do something to take that anxiety and push it away. So we buy flowers. And the flowers are going to fix it. I know, babe, let's go on a vacation. That'll fix everything. If we could just get to Hawaii, right? The problem in Hawaii is it smells just like you. In AA, we call that a geographical cure. Right? Because we think by changing geography, because you wake up in the morning, you look in the mirror, and there you are. Shoot. I thought I was going to leave my problems in Calgary because it was Calgary's fault, because I'm the victim. Don't you know? And when I'm the victim, and then I get angry, and I blow up, and I'm going to Hawaii again. Shoot, it's not working. Right? And I come back over here. Right? Freaking, it's raining in Hawaii. What the frick is that about? Right? And I come back over here and I freaking gonna get drunk again. It's like, darn it. Wasn't supposed to do that in Hawaii. It's supposed to be nice here. And then you feel shame again. Freaking shame is everywhere because it's me. Right? And I come back over here. Let's stay another week. Babe, we're gonna stay another week. It's awesome. Right? But I'm come back over here and I've lost my power again. And we could stay on that. How many of you know you can visit each one of these chairs in like 3 minutes? right? We're coming over here. It's a whoa, blow up. Babe, so sorry. Super, super sorry. Let's just go. You don't have to cook this morning. We'll go out for lunch. Okay? Some of you have already done that today. You got mad at your spouse on the way. It's okay, babe. You don't have to cook anything. We'll go out. We'll go to Brown Social. Right? Listen, Swiss Chalet has made a business model on this. And then we come back over here and we're victim again because it doesn't work. And we go around and around on this triad. And Cartman says, we get dizzy on here. Some people live and die on this triad. On your tombstone, it goes, here lies the victim, the persecutor, and the rescuer. Now, I don't know about you. When I saw this, I went, wait a minute. Is this my destiny? Because I look at the children of Israel, it's how they lived. Generations of it. And that's why these narratives are in there, because psychologically they were trying to get their anxiety down. How do we get off this triad? Well, here's what Cartman said. The opposite of being victim. What do you have to do in life to get off the victim chair? What's the one thing you got to do? Come on. What? Own it? Okay, what's that? What's another term for that? Take responsibility. It's my life. The only person getting in the way of me being amazing is me. The only person getting in the way of you being the most amazing human being you can be is who? It's you. You are not a victim. That's the point. Once you get that, you go, oh, you mean I got to take responsibility for my life? What a novel thought. In other words, it's my life. I create my results in life. They're mine. And the second I take responsibility, I now have the power to make choices. I have the power to act out, or I can look at options. Instead of acting out, what are some of the options? Instead of going out and using one of my addictions or having a fight or whatever it might be, what are some options? See, because the alcoholic goes, there's only one option, the bottle. It's unconscious. I'm just going to go drink. But once you realize, you go, well, nevertheless, that's an option. Is it the most healthy option? Right? Now, I know for some of you, your addictions are a little more subtle. Here's mine. I'm the victim. I'm sitting by myself, feeling quite alone. My wife doesn't understand me. My kids don't appreciate me. I'm wonderful, but they don't get it. Right? And so I'm feeling lonely. I get feeling angry. And here's what I do. Ice cream. Right? Now, is that a choice, or am I powerless over ice cream? Hello? Yeah, it's a choice. Right? But here's how I feel. When I'm a victim, I don't feel powerful. It's inevitable. And Haagen-Dazs it is. Right? Because I have no power. But as soon as I say, okay, wait a minute, that's a possible, but is there a healthier choice? Am I actually hungry? Am I hungry enough right now to eat broccoli? Hell no. So I don't need the ice cream. So there are other choices that I can make. I can have a conversation. I can connect. I can get out of my loneliness and out of my victim. And then instead of rescuing, which some of you, by the way, that's like a profession for you. Hello? How many rescuers here? Come on, you own it. Oh, we got two people being honest. Okay. We rescue and rescue and rescue. Some of you have children so that you can take up this occupation because you are busy rescuing your children, and they know, and they've learned very quickly. Mom or dad is the rescuer. Mom, I got a problem. Okay, babe, I'll be right there. Hello. We watched on that Netflix movie, The Book Club, the other night. Anybody seen that? Diane Keaton? Yeah, brilliant. She got two adult kids, And it's like she's made a profession of rescuing. And she said, actually, I'm going to grow up. I'm going to take my power back. And instead of rescuing, I'm going to ask for help. Get a coach. Get someone who's going to have another voice, who's going to see things differently. And so we have a choice. We can live unconsciously as the victim, the persecutor, the rescuer, or we can take responsibility for our life. We can look at options and we can ask for help. And if you look at the narrative of the people of Israel, psychologically, they managed their anxiety in different ways. And as they developed, and as they moved from the chaos and the empty spaces of the desert of Paran, and they then moved into the promised land, and they settled, and order became present. Civil engineering began to take place. The laws that they implemented started to make sense. They moved from chaos to order, from stress to peace. And part of our spirituality and our health and our well-being is learning to walk in peace. And that comes from taking our anxiety from a place of unconsciousness to a place of consciousness where we can make choices. Now, I know this morning, most of you sitting here are going, well, that I don't want to be a victim. That's not where I want to live. I don't want to be a persecutor. I don't want to be. I get it. I just need to take full responsibility for my life. There's a prayer that we pray at the end of AA meetings. It goes something like this, and I'd like to pray it as we close this morning. Would you all stand with me as we... Some of you may know this prayer. Maybe you've been to a meeting. Maybe you haven't. You've just kind of seen it as a poster on the side of the wall. But it goes like this. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Have an awesome week. God bless you.